London Calling. David here. Story time. I realized earlier this year that I've now read about 1,000 books on London. The figure at first came as a shock, but then when I thought it through, it made perfect sense. It's not as though it's been a hard slog, arduous reading 10 hours a day at it. Hardly. You know, an hour, hour and a half, 30, 35, 40 pages a day. At the end of 18, 20 days, you know, you're through a 700-page book. And 20 books a year times nearly half a century now, that's 1,000 books. Now, obviously, Dickens has been the cornerstone of my London reading. I mean, Dickens is the reason I'm in this country. I came over here to do the PhD at the University of London and just stayed. And I try to reread Dickens every 2 or 3 years. But mostly, the last 30 years or so, it's been London history. A few of the books are masterpieces. I've read them 3, 4, 5 times. In my estimation, apart from the Dickens novels, the two best books, one is very new. It's by Simon Jenkins, the distinguished journalist. It's called A Short History of London. It's published last year. And the other one is by V.S. Pritchett. Book's probably 60 years old. It's called London Perceived. Pritchett was the 20th century novelist, short story writer, essayist, etc. Now, you know, London's got into all three of us, and I'm not lumping myself in with those two in any sense, you know, apart from, you know, our fascination with this city. I often think about Antony and Cleopatra, that great moment in that play, early on in the play. A couple of Romans, Maecenas and Enobarbus, are talking about the situation, and Maecenas has heard the news that, you know, Antony's been summoned back to Rome. And he says, you know, he's going to have to go back now. The actual line is, "No, Antony must leave her utterly." And Enobarbus says, "Never. He will not. Age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. Other women cloy the appetites they feed, but she makes hungry where most she satisfies." And I think that pretty well describes London. You just never get tired of this place. It's so stimulating, over and over and over, endlessly fascinating. Anyway, I said story time because Simon on Sunday night is doing his new virtual tour. It's an anniversary tour. It's the 80th anniversary of the Blitz. And it'll be one of three virtual tours doing that day. In fact, I'm doing one earlier in the day on Kensington. But, you know, Simon really is the headline. He's become the headline act with these things. He just does them so well. The delivery is perfect, and his research is second to none. The visuals are just to die for. So I'll be there. I'll be in attendance. I'm very much looking forward to that one. But that's coming into view, really brought to mind this wonderful passage in V.S. Pritchett's London Perceived, one of my two favorite books on London. And that's why I call this story time. I'm going to read this passage to you. It goes like this. "To the Londoner of my generation, the London sky has another dramatic significance, which, since our present boredom with the whole subject is overcome, is memorable. it has been a battlefield. One day in 1940, in the entrance hall of the BBC, I heard the sirens howl. One of the maternal ladies at the reception desk called out, "Air raid, please!" One is inclined in London to say please for everything, and one must certainly say it out of deference if a VIP like the Angel of Death is announced. But she was in fact telling the boys to close the steel shutters. I shall not forget that large white cloud bellying against the blue in the afternoon. And as my stomach turned over, seeing a flight of silver Spitfires dive into it, I froze with fear, hope, anger, pity. Many times afterwards, Londoners in the blackout heard the sky grunt, grunt, grunt above them, then howl and rock, or saw it go green instead of black, the whole 700 square miles of it twitching like sick electricity and hammered all over by millions of sharp gold sparks as the barrage beat against it like steel against a steel door. The curling magnesium ribbons that came slowly down were a relief to see in that unremitting noise. The sky shook London like a rug. The floorboards, the furniture, the pictures, the glasses and plates, the curtains, the favorite vases, ferns, clocks, and photographs, the pens on the desks, the ink in the pots danced in their places throughout the night, in evil monotony hard to endure. The sky was extravagant. The earth would occasionally come to life in scattered, carroty fires. And on the bad nights, when the docks, the East End, and the city were burned out, the tide being too low to give the firemen water, London turned crimson. Even then, people made the historic remark, the remark of experience. Nothing like this, they said, had been seen since 1666. One cloudless August afternoon near the end of the war, green snow fell in minute, insulting particles all over Holborn. We saw them when we got up from under our desks, where we had ducked when a bomb had fallen a mile or so away in Hyde Park, and had blown the leaves off the trees into these mysterious smithereens. It had seemed, for a moment, like a new venture of the London climate, which we knew to be capable of anything. 700,000 dwellings were damaged in the County of London, that is to say, more than 80% of the total. And of these, nearly a third were totally destroyed. Little was left of the docks or the city, and about 30,000 people were killed, more than 50,000 injured. On 29 December 1940, all Paternoster Row went, and a favorite phrase imported from American films was that London can take it, whatever that may mean. London did nothing so exhibitionist, showed none of the characteristics of the prize fighter's ring, as seen by publicity agents. London was quite simply morose, fatalistic, frightened, depressed, and fell back on that general practicality of mind that counts as calm. The climate had predisposed us to expect the worst, and to disbelieve in the facts. Fatalism is the English religion. London can take it is just the beer talking. At the George in Great Portland Street, I do recall two drunks discussing the kind of funeral they wanted, with a lot of circumstantial detail about the correct amount of flowers during a bad half hour. And there is no one who could not supply a list of old aunts, grandmothers, and so on, who stuck the thing out, immovably, sustained by a vigorous social disapproval of the whole schmozzle. private life rules the world. It was the silence of London in the early evening that struck one. One had never known it to be dead quiet before. The machine had stopped. One walked down mile after mile of empty streets to the sound of one's own heels only, and voices carried far as if across water. I remember two painted old crones sitting out alone on a bench in Lincoln's Inn Fields when I was fire-watching. They were, no doubt, caretakers, and I could hear their voices far across the square. They were talking about actresses and distant connections of the royal family, of course. One night, I saw a soldier come fighting out of a pub and get his teeth knocked out. One could hear them fall as distinctly as pebbles, 100 yards away.